It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, the Reedsburg Fermentation Fest starts this weekend, and fermentation master Sandor Katz joins us for the why and how of healthy fermentation.
First, with an October 1st deadline looming, Congress finally passed a stopgap budget bill to avoid another government shutdown and allocate federal dollars to issues like Zika and the Flint water crisis.
And the Senate had a first this week. They voted almost unanimously to override a presidential veto on a 9/11 bill, and President Obama was not happy with that move.
Donovan Slack joins us now. She covers Washington for USA Today. Donovan, welcome back to Central Time. Donovan, are you there?
Yes.
Great. Thanks for joining us. So in a nutshell, what's the story behind how this bill got passed, how this is a spending measure got passed?
Well, as you say, as you said earlier, it's a stopgap spending measure. There was several weeks here of back and forth political flurry, and then all of a sudden yesterday, both sides reached a deal. They passed the spending bill funding the government through December 9th, which is just about 6 weeks. And then they all left town. So here on Capitol Hill, there's nothing but a bunch of jet fumes at this point.
So why did it take so long for this to get passed? What was holding it up?
I mean, there were several issues on both sides. Democrats wanted the Flint water funding included. Republicans wanted to include the Louisiana flood funding, emergency funding. There were some interesting talk about requiring the SEC requiring companies to divulge political donations, just a bunch of side issues that were really not part of keeping the government open.
It seems as though this has become the new norm. I mean, the government did actually shut down for a while a couple of years ago, but since then it always seems like there's a last-minute scramble. Why is that?
It's just right now, the way Congress is currently working or not working, as it were, it is kind of lurching from one funding deadline to another. They are not working on what's called regular process, which means passing individual spending bills that last for an entire year. Instead, they're resulting to these what we call omnibus bills, which kind of fund everything for a certain period of time, kind of just to get them through the next deadline.
And going back to the specifics, now you mentioned Flint's water crisis as being part of the holdup. Tell us more about what was actually decided and what's still left to do to take to care of the rest of it.
Well, so the Flint funding is not actually in the bill that passed yesterday. What it did get into is a different bill that Republicans have promised to pass in December. So the Flint funding did not actually get done. However, Dems were satisfied with Republican pledges that that would happen in December.
Now, it sounds like not all Democrats were satisfied. It sounds like there were some holdouts who were skeptical that this would actually happen come December.
And there are still some skeptics. And, of course, knowing this Congress, time will tell. But they felt strongly enough about it that they went along with funding the government and didn't hold it up.
Now, another aspect that we haven't talked about is Zika funding. Where does that stand?
Well, that is part of the package. It's $1.1 billion, I think. Of course, the White House and the administration are saying, yeah, that's great. We asked you for this in February. They're feeling a little bit behind the curve, but at least it's passed and it's on its way now.
I understand there was some disagreement around Zika funding that had to do with differing points of view about Planned Parenthood. Can you explain some of that for us?
Yeah, there was definitely some holdups. There were several Planned Parenthood clinics in Puerto Rico that Republicans didn't want them to be able to get any of this funding, obviously for pro-life reasons. The Democrats are saying that's crazy. Zika can be transmitted sexually, so we want to make sure these clinics are funded so that they can provide contraception. At the end of the day, they worked out their differences, and the Planned Parenthood clinics, I don't know exactly the details, except that they were not accepted. They were not defunded as part of this package.
And, you know, this Congress, it has record unpopularity ratings. People don't like this Congress, but the political system as a whole, there's a lot going on. We're in the middle of a presidential election with two very unpopular candidates. So overall, does the public care about things like this, a last-minute scramble for a budget bill?
You know, I don't think they care except when the government shuts down and, you know, things in their state, in their region, all of a sudden stop working. And I think, as you said, the record unpopularity in general of Washington and, of course, of the presidential candidates just is a sign of the times right now and is perhaps will be the impetus for some changes going forward. Of course, we've said that before.
Donovan Slack is with us right now. She covers Washington for USA Today, looking at a couple measures out of Washington. And one interesting, the Senate did something unique this week, something it's never done, I gather, when it voted to override President Obama's veto of a 9/11 bill. Can you tell us that story?
It was actually a huge historic moment. This happened yesterday. And the Senate and the House both voted to override the veto. So it's the first veto override of Obama's presidency. He has, I think, vetoed 12 bills in all, and this is the one that got turned back. So it will become law. And what was interesting about it is that it was overwhelming. I think the Senate vote was 97-1, which means that Obama's allies, Democratic allies on the Hill, have joined with Republicans to turn this back. And it was really a lobbying push by the families of the victims and survivors of the 9/11 attacks who have been pushing for the chance to sue the Saudi government in U.S. courts. Right now, there's something called sovereign immunity, where countries don't sue other countries in their courts, but this carved out an exception. And, of course, this will become law now. But the families have been pushing, and it was on the 15th anniversary this year in September of the attacks that it really came on strong. And their argument was persuasive enough to give, as I said, Obama his first veto override.
And Donovan, as we wrap up, the president has said that this was something that was it would have been hard for Congress to vote otherwise, but he said it would have been the right thing to do to leave his veto in place. What is he concerned about when it comes to the United States standing with foreign governments, and in particular Saudi Arabia?
Well, it's basically the fact that the law opens all countries up to this. Right now, people can sue other countries in this way if they are state sponsors of terrorism, which is a designation, obviously, the United States government makes. Under this law, they don't have to be state sponsors of terrorism, which basically opens it up to every country in the world. And the president's concern is that other countries will then strip our immunity, meaning our American service members, diplomatic personnel in other countries, can then be sued. For example, if we do a drone strike in Afghanistan and we hit, collateral damage, civilians die, and can their family members then sue the United States government? It just opens this whole can of worms.
And we leave it there. Donovan, thank you so much for being with us today.
No problem, Veronica. Thanks for having me.
That was Donovan Slack. She covers Washington for USA Today, and she joined us to talk about congressional action on the federal budget and the first ever override of a veto by President Obama.
Fermentation Fest starts this weekend. For 9 days, this Reedsburg Festival will celebrate live culture of all types, from art to sauerkraut and poetry to pickles.
Calling itself a live culture convergence, the festival will feature food tastings and demos, cooking classes, art installations, and live performances. Fermentation master Sandor Katz will be there. He's a food writer, a DIY food activist, and self-proclaimed fermentation revivalist. He's also the author of the book The Art of Fermentation and Wild Fermentation, which have just been revised and re-released.
Sandor Katz joins us now. Sandor, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Well, you've described yourself as a fermentation revivalist. Now, that implies bringing something back, but almost with a religious feel to it. Can you talk about your role as a fermentation revivalist?
Well, I mean, that's kind of where the wordplay comes in. But, you know, fermentation is an incredibly important practice. And, you know, it is part of the story of how people have made effective use of the food resources available to them in every part of the world. All of our greatest delicacies are products of fermentation. You know, unfortunately, in our age of food mass production and, you know, convenience one-stop shopping, you know, most people have lost any direct connection to this important, you know, transformative phenomenon that's so important to our food. So, you know, and yet these are, you know, critical cultural practices, you know, an essential piece of the puzzle of how people have made effective use of food resources. So, you know, I'm a revivalist in the sense that, you know, I am trying to, you know, revive the skills, the knowledge, the cultural practices, you know, that have never disappeared, but they have lost prominence. And, you know, in many cases, people have, you know, not been passing down these cultural traditions from generation to generation. So I think, you know, they are in need of revival at exactly the same time as, you know, we are in need of, you know, more nutritious food and a greater connection to our food and how it's produced.
One thing I've learned at past fermentation fests is that we come into contact with fermented foods that have been through some kind of fermentation process all the time and are really not aware of it. Can you talk about the range of foods we might encounter that have some kind of fermentation?
Sure. I mean, almost every individual in almost every part of the world eats and drinks products of fermentation every day. One scholar of fermentation came to the conclusion that one-third of all food that human beings put into our mouths has been transformed by fermentation before we eat it. In the standard American diet, some examples would be coffee, bread, cheese, cured meats, all the condiments we like to put on our sandwiches, and chocolate, vanilla. You know, I could go on and on. I mean, people eat and drink products of fermentation every day without being aware of it. You don't have to be aware of it to, you know, sort of enjoy the flavors of fermentation. You walk into a gourmet food store anywhere, and almost all you're going to see and smell are products of fermentation.
It'd be a pretty bleak world without all of those things, for sure.
Yeah.
Now, you're interested in how fermented foods contribute to our health, and by eating more fermented foods and less mass-produced foods, we'll be healthier people. Can you talk about that?
Well, sure. I mean, there are lots of different aspects to it. I mean, for one thing, the process of fermentation pre-digests food and breaks down nutrients into more easily accessible forms. So, you know, the nutrients in our food tend to be more available to us after the food has been fermented. But, you know, beyond that, there's all this new interest in the microbiome and and recognition that the bacteria that are part of our bodies play incredibly huge roles in terms of our ability to effectively digest food, in terms of our immune function. We're learning that it also extends to our mental health and almost every aspect of our functionality, you know, and yet because of chemical exposure, you know, to chlorine, antibacterial cleansing products, antibiotic drugs, you know, we are all walking around with diminished biodiversity of these bacteria that are so important to us. And eating sauerkraut, yogurt, other kinds of fermented foods that have not been cooked or heat processed so that the bacteria are still alive and intact is a great way of restoring biodiversity in our intestines so that we can have, you know, better overall digestion, better overall immune function, and potentially better overall mental health.
Sandor, I better ask you before we get too much further, can you give us a basic definition of what it means when we say a food is fermented?
Well, I would define fermentation in lay terms as the transformative action of microorganisms. They're, you know, foods or beverages, you know, that have been transformed in some way by yeast or other types of microorganisms acting on the food.
We are talking to Sandor Katz about fermentation. He'll be appearing at Fermentation Fest here in Wisconsin. Sandor, there's a theme that keeps coming up on our show lately with different guests, this idea that microbes, bacteria, not that long ago, we thought of them almost exclusively as pathogens, as bad guys, as things that cause disease. It seems like we're undergoing this huge change where we realize they do, a lot of them, way more good than harm.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say, you know, for any of us who grew up in the United States in the 20th century, you know, we were indoctrinated into what I would describe as the war on bacteria. And so, you know, in our imaginations, you know, bacteria are primarily, you know, related to, you know, disease and danger and possible death. And, you know, certainly in the last couple of decades, you know, science has increasingly been coming to the recognition that, you know, bacteria are essentially the building blocks of life. In evolutionary biology, there is a broad consensus that all life is evolved from bacteria. And the flip side of this is that no multicellular form of life has ever lived without bacteria. They're just essential parts of us. In our human bodies, you know, our bodily cells are outnumbered by bacteria that we're host to, and these bacteria, you know, provide an array of essential services for us, and we couldn't possibly thrive. We probably couldn't even possibly survive without them. So, you know, we are utterly dependent on bacteria, you know, which in a certain way are our ancestors. So, and that's not to deny the existence of certain organisms that, you know, can make us sick, but in reality, our greatest protection against the organisms that can make us sick is to have a healthy, thriving population of bacteria that keep us healthy, because they're what protect us from the really limited range of pathogens.
All right, Sandor, I want to try this at home now. And I think what a lot of people might think about, you know, fermenting, I think about my grandparents making their own sauerkraut. I understand you have some more general advice if we want to ferment vegetables, not just turning cabbage into sauerkraut. Talk us through some of the basics of what we can do at home.
Sure. I mean, sauerkraut is a method. It's the dry salting method of fermenting vegetables. And you can ferment really any kinds of vegetables using this method. So the essential condition is getting the vegetables submerged. If the vegetables have a continual flow of oxygen in fresh air, then they will generally mold. So the strategy for making sauerkraut is getting the vegetables submerged under their own juices. So you chop or grate or otherwise shred the vegetables, which creates surface area. Then you lightly salt them. Don't get too caught up on a precise amount of salt. Salt them to taste. Mix it up. I like to get it with my hands and squeeze them, which kind of breaks down some cell walls and helps release juice. And I do that for 5 or 10 minutes until the vegetables get nice and juicy. I can pick up a little handful, squeeze them, and they're like a wet sponge, and juice comes out. Once the vegetables are nice and juicy like that, and I taste them and make sure that I have enough salt, you know, just for my own culinary pleasure, you know, then I just stuff them into a jar. I like to use a wide-mouth quart jar. A wide-mouth quart jar will take about 2 pounds of vegetables, and just sort of stuff it in there with some force so you get the vegetables submerged under liquid. And then, you know, ferment them. The amount of time is not standardized. It's really subjective. You know, it'll get more acidic, more sour as the days and weeks pass by. And some people love it best after, you know, 4 or 5 days. And some people like to give it 2 or 3 weeks. If you had a cool, unheated cellar, you could let it keep fermenting slowly all winter long. You know, which is the traditional way that it was done. But, you know, if it ever reaches a point where you think, wow, that's strong enough, I don't want it to get any more sour than that, move it into your fermentation slowing device in your kitchen, which is what a refrigerator amounts to.
I've got a producer here making a face at these descriptions. And sauerkraut, a lot of things like that, an acquired taste. Can you encourage us to, whether we make it ourselves or try somebody else's, to give more fermented foods a try?
Well, I mean, I would say, like, for people who don't like sauerkraut, try a lightly fermented batch. I mean, the traditional food is something that people would ferment for, you know, weeks and months, and it would get very, very sour. And if that's too strong of a flavor for you, try fermenting it for, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 days, and you might love it. I've had many people say, I thought I didn't like sauerkraut. but this is delicious. But you just need to bear in mind that the acidity accumulates over time. But yes, in general, fermented foods are what I would describe as acquired tastes. And cheese offers such a great illustration of this. You know, as my taste has evolved, like, I love really ripe, stinky cheeses that you can smell from 100 feet away. But I definitely have learned that not everybody shares my passion for these kinds of strong flavors. But fermentation creates strong flavors, and not everybody loves every flavor of fermentation. But, once people learn to love them, they tend to get very passionate about them. And this is why what you find stocked in gourmet stores are almost exclusively products of fermentation, because it creates these, you know, compelling, exciting flavors. But some of the flavors are things that, are definitely acquired tastes.
As we wrap up, Sandor, are you seeing a big turning point here? Are people listening? Are we seeing more people get into fermented foods?
Well, I mean, you know, I think that certainly there is a growing awareness of fermentation and interest in fermentation. I don't think that the foods and beverages that are products of fermentation really ever waned in popularity. But certainly there's greater interest. I think partly because of the greater interest in bacteria and the greater understanding that, you know, we really need to restore biodiversity in our guts for health. And the other is, I think that just in general, people are getting more interested in, you know, food, how it's produced, where it comes from, what kinds of processes it undergoes. And once you start, you know, interrogating your food and asking questions about how it's prepared, fermentation just is always part of the answer.
Sandor, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Sandor Katz, food writer, DIY food activist, and self-proclaimed fermentation revivalist. His books include The Art of Fermentation and Wild Fermentation. You can catch him at Fermentation Fest, which starts this weekend in Reedsburg. For details, go to fermentationfest.com. The human settlement on Mars inched a little further from the pages of science fiction into potential real-life future this week. Entrepreneur Elon Musk is the founder of SpaceX, among other things, and earlier this week he gave a talk and released a video unveiling his plans for putting people on the red planet.
He laid out a vision for the ship that would take people there, the engines that would power the ship, and the propulsion mechanism that would keep it moving, and the domes and other buildings that people could live in once they got there.
He says the first ship could leave as early as 6 years from now, starting a decades-long process of shuttling people through space, thousands of people a year, once things get rolling.
Science writer Rebecca Boyle joins us now. She wrote about the Mars announcement for The Atlantic magazine, and she's a longtime fan of Mars. Rebecca, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So before we get rolling, here's Elon Musk himself unveiling his plan earlier this week.
As we show that this is possible, that this dream is real, not just a dream, it can still be something that can be made real. I think the support will snowball over time. And I should say also that the main reason I'm personally accumulating assets is in order to fund this. So I really don't have any other motivation for personally accumulating assets except to be able to make the biggest contribution I can to making life multiplanetary.
So Elon Musk at the beginning there saying this is more than just a dream. This could be real, and he thinks it's closer to being real. Do you buy that?
I think if anybody could actually try, it's him. He started out after selling his company PayPal to eBay for $1.5 billion, doing two things that seemed kind of silly at the time, which is entering the both rocketry market and the car market, both of which, you know, are well-funded, sort of old-school institutions in this country. And he was able to make an impact in both of those sectors. So in less than, you know, two decades, I'll say. So, you know, I mean, he's pretty ambitious, but he's pulled off some pretty surprising feats already. And so I think, you know, if anyone actually has a shot, it's probably Elon Musk.
And even if this exact plan that he laid out isn't the way it happens, is he painting the path, I guess, toward a practical way to get people to Mars and maybe inspiring other people to jump in the game?
Yeah, I think so. And that's one of his stated goals in this talk that he gave this week. Intentionally, it was at an international gathering of people who are interested in space exploration. It's the International Astronautical Federation. They meet every year in different countries. And, you know, he could have talked to NASA about this. He could have given a speech at any of the number of U.S.-based planetary science conferences that happened throughout the year, but he chose on purpose an international audience, which I think is part of, you know, intending to get people on board with this, more from, you know, around the world, where it seems like it might be more possible than what the space programs of the past have been able to pull off.
And that whole concept of having life, human life, be multi-planetary, I mean, that's pretty seductive for anyone who loves science fiction and is worried about, you know, the problems, environmental problems on Earth. I can see people getting on board with that. Do you think that his mission has broad appeal?
I think it does. And I think, you know, Mars has always kind of loomed large in science fiction, partly because it's so much like the early Earth, or we think that it's much like the early Earth. And it's been a target for, you know, people who want to create an Earth 2.0, at least in science fiction. So it gives us a sense of, you know, being able to start again. But knowing what we know now about civilizations and about agriculture and, you know, it's kind of starting from the ground up, but in a way that we can control it, which is a pretty compelling thing to think about. I think, you know, that has a lot of appeal for people all around the world.
We're talking to science writer Rebecca Boyle about Elon Musk's speech earlier this week, laying out a path to Mars colonization. Rebecca, let's get on board the ship that might take us, well, not me anyway, but take some people to Mars. How did he describe this ship? What does it look like? What would life be like on it?
It sort of looks like, it resembles a maybe chubbier, flatter space shuttle. It's a little more round than the iconic, you know, delta wing shape that we all knew in the 80s and 90s from the space shuttle. But the you know, idea is the same. It looks sort of like an airplane-style design with a large nose cone. It has windows in the front, which is pretty exciting to think about, but also really ambitious in terms of safety and practicality. Windows weigh a lot, and, you know, if one were to be damaged in liftoff or in during the transit to Mars over the course of 9 months, that would be a huge problem. But it's sort of a dreamy ship. I mean, you know, the idea is to put at least 100 people on board, maybe 200 people if he scales it up at some point. He talked about having restaurants on board, you know, pizzerias, things like that, zero gravity games. He said at one point, it'll be really fun to go. And I think that's going to have to be part of the sale, frankly. Otherwise, it's sort of a depressing prospect to think about leaving Earth and going to a frozen desert for the rest of your life. So if they at least have some games, maybe it'll be a good time.
Right, and also the safety concerns, right? I mean, I don't check the news from SpaceX every day, but it seems like an awful lot of the ships blow up, and people might not want to get on one that's going to Mars.
Yeah, you know, that's one key thing. They have to figure out first how to first prevent their rockets from exploding on the launch pad, which is hard to do. And, you know, in fairness, he pointed out at a media conference after this initial speech that he gets a lot more attention when things do go wrong than other companies. And there are other people trying to do what they're doing as well. But SpaceX is sort of the, you know, the flashier, more charismatic private company going for the stars. And so it is more notable when they have a mishap, or so far no tragedy as far as people have not lost any life or limb. But they continue to have accidents both in liftoff and landing, and they still have to prove they can send astronauts to just a space station, which, you know, is a feat by itself, let alone going to somewhere as far as Mars. So that's definitely the tricky part, is proving that they can pull this off safely.
Yeah, Elon Musk, not 100% rosy about the safety. Somebody asked him about, you know, who should be first? Should we have families? Should we have children on the first missions to Mars? Here's what he had to say.
Well, I think the first journeys to Mars are going to be really very dangerous. The risk of fatality will be high. There's just no way around it. So I would not suggest having sending children, or it would be basically, are you prepared to die? Then that's okay, then, you know, you're a candidate for going.
So at first hearing that, you think, oh, wow, well, who would want to go on that? But then you think humans that have been exploring stuff, taking huge risks to cross oceans and deserts and whatnot in the past, still probably there'd be a lot of people lining up to take that very risky trip, don't you think?
I think so. I mean, you know, it's sort of an exciting prospect, and I think there are definitely people who would sign up to risk their lives for something as incredible as going to Mars and settling Mars. But yeah, it's certainly dangerous. I mean, Mars is hard. Mars is difficult to get to. So far, only the U.S. has ever landed anything there. The Soviet Union tried in the 70s, tried again. Russia tried again in the last several years. was not successful. The European Space Agency tried in 2003 to land a probe there, and it crashed. They're actually trying again in about 2 weeks. A small lander is supposed to arrive at Mars, built by the European Space Agency. It's difficult to get even robots there, let alone people, and it's incredibly dangerous. So I think if, you know, the first few times anyone tries, there's a very high probability of failure, just given the statistics.
Yeah, I don't know if I agree with you guys that people would want to go. He just said the first question you have to answer is, are you prepared to die? Who's going to want to do that? I don't know. Maybe some people, I can imagine some people will, but it makes me wonder, Rebecca, if he's screening it all for a certain psychological profile. Also, people, when they get there, are they, you know, made of sturdy stuff and they can deal with whatever obstacles come up if they even make it there?
Yeah, I think that's, you know, you'd have to have a certain type of personality to be able to risk that, you know, the danger that would be involved in this kind of mission. And that does make you wonder about the kind of personalities that would go, and would they mesh? You know, if we have 100 people who are all sort of willing to die for adventure, I would imagine that those people would have strong personalities in one way or another, and they'd have to all get along, you know, on the surface of another planet and probably not be able to come back, at least for quite some time. So you have to think about that too, like who gets along, and do their personalities of people who are willing to die mesh well with, you know, being in close environments for a very long time under high stress? That's a big question.
On the technological side, in this presentation, he talked about the engine, a Raptor engine. He talked about the technology, putting propulsant material out there in stations, not just to get to Mars, but beyond. But as you say, he's still not getting people up to the space station. And he's saying, hey, maybe 6-ish years, we're going to be sending the first people there. Is that doable? I mean, that much technological change in a 6-year span?
I mean, that's extremely ambitious, and even later on in the day, he did say that, you know, I would consider that aspirational. It would be probably after that, but, you know, not too far after that. But, yeah, I mean, one thing about going to Mars is that you really only have a window every 18 months or so because of the way that Mars and Earth orbit the sun. You want to go when they're pretty close together and in their alignment around the sun, and that only happens every so often. So that's a big part of the timing in planning a Mars mission, is if you miss that window, you have to wait, you know, 18 months to 2 years to try again. And so the longer you wait, the more often you push it off, the further away it gets. So I think that's part of why you want to push a little more. But yeah, I mean, a six-year time frame for building the biggest rocket ever built, the biggest spaceship ever built, to go where no one literally has ever gone before is pretty ambitious.
Rebecca Boyle is with us right now. She's a science writer and contributor to The Atlantic, and we're talking about Mars and a new plan released this week by SpaceX founder Elon Musk to get humans there sooner than we might have thought, 6 years.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Given the opportunity and given the risks, would you want to go to Mars in the first round, maybe, or wait till things get a little more settled, head in later? Would you maybe, this is one thing Elon Musk talked about, sell your house to be able to afford one of the earlier fares on a rocket to the red planet? Would you stay or would you go? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're continuing our conversation with science writer Rebecca Boyle, looking at the Mars colonization plans laid out this week by entrepreneur Elon Musk. He's hoping to start getting people to Mars over the next decade, and the ultimate goal to create a self-sustaining colony there of humans in the next 50 to 100 years.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Would you go to Mars? Are you one of the people who would sign up to do that? Would you stand in line? Would you pay to do that? Would you want to be one of the first colonists on Mars, despite the risk? Why? Why not? Maybe you'd like to join in later after the colony gets rolling. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Does it sound cool to you, being one of the first people on Mars? Again, 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
I think you kind of hit it, Rob. It sounds cool, but would I actually do it? Right. I would not do it. Would you do it?
Probably not. Probably
what about
motion
you, Rebecca?
Sickness and all that? Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. A long trip too. Rebecca, what about you?
It's funny. My answer to this has sort of evolved along the path of probability of this plan. So, you know, a few years ago, I was like, Oh, yeah, absolutely. I would go. And I want to be the first journalist on Mars. That's fantastic, you know, because in part it seemed really impossible. It's easy to talk about those things when they're so far-fetched that they seem unrealistic. And, like, in your dreams, you could pull it off. But as this has gotten more realistic, I don't know. And actually, Musk seems to be in a similar mind. You know, a few years ago, he said he would be willing to die on Mars. And, in fact, that's a plan of his, is to die on Mars. But then on Tuesday, he said he wouldn't go, at least for the first few trips. He has kids. He wants to see them grow up. And so now he seems like he's backed off of it, too. And I wonder about that, if it's because this is maybe not as much of a pipe dream as it used to be. Maybe you're a little bit hesitant now that it seems realistic.
Well, let's look down the road a bit. I mean, as you say, Mars, a harsh place to live. Is there talk about, is he talking about how one would terraform the planet, change it to be more Earth-like so it's easier for humans to live there?
Yeah, he talked about doing it. He didn't talk about how. And that's sort of the whole, you know, the only question that matters, actually. And it's not like this would be easy at all. And he had this video to go with the speech that he presented on Tuesday. And in the end, it shows the ship arriving and people opening the doors to this, like, sun-dappled red surface. And then Mars starts to spin, indicating, you know, time is passing. And then after a few spins, a few years, presumably, Mars is all of a sudden watery and has, you know, looks like to be oceans and clouds and much more like Earth. And that's sort of the ultimate goal, I guess, if you're wanting life to become interplanetary. But, you know, making that happen is still pretty much in the realm of science fiction.
We'll take our first caller now. We've got Clyde on the line in Eau Claire. Hello, Clyde.
Hello. Yes, it's an interesting thought, going to Mars, but I would not be a candidate.
Why not?
Some of the things you've talked about as far as the state of mind that they should be in to take on such a journey. Wow, you want to spend the rest of your life with 100 or 200 people that have that mindset? I think I'd be going, no, I don't think so. I don't think that's a good idea.
Right, Clyde. I think that there are more things beyond the pizzeria on the rocket ship that are going to be needed to entice people to go, unless you do have that disposition, I guess. Rebecca, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think it appeals to a certain pioneering spirit that we've always had in this country, at least, of, you know, moving on to the next frontier. But yeah, I mean, talking about leaving your loved ones, everything you've ever known, for a barren wasteland from which you'll never return is kind of a depressing thing to think about. You know, I mean, when people settled this continent, Europeans settled this continent, you know, it was more like, wow, there's plenty of resources there that we could exploit and we could build this wonderful new life and have opportunities that we didn't have, you know, in other continents. But that's not the case on Mars. You know, it's not better than Earth, certainly.
I don't know, it reminds me of the Polynesians who settled, you know, all of the Polynesian islands, and they got in these canoes and went hundreds of miles. And is there another island out there? We don't know. But eventually, you know, some of them probably didn't make it. Some of them did. I don't know. I still think people would do it. Clyde, thank you so much for that call. I'll go next to Greg in DeKalb. Greg, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What do you think?
I think it's interesting. My question relates to international law and how does that apply to this? Like, can his company claim it and monetize Mars? Is that why he's pushing so hard for this? Or how does all that come into play?
Greg, thanks for that call. I understand he talked some about some kind of public-private partnership, Rebecca, but I assume there's not a whole lot of Earth law that answers Greg's questions, is there?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, this is new ground. There is an outer space treaty that was signed by the U.S. and the Soviet Union back in the 60s during the space race, and it does address to some degree this question of ownership. You know, it's pretty clear that no celestial body can be claimed by any specific country or corporation. But there are trickier elements to that. Like, if you arrive, you set up an outpost or some sort of settlement, you have to be able to extract resources and exploit them for your own use. And at some point, there has to be a monetary incentive for that, at least if you believe in capitalism. you know, and that's a lot less clear. Like, does SpaceX get to claim all the methane on Mars to use to make rocket fuel? And, you know, if so, then does other people have to pay for that in order to get back home? That's all really unclear right now. And that's something that Musk didn't address. And I don't think that anyone has really addressed in quite some time.
Greg, thanks a lot for that call. And we'll go next to Tree in Madison. Hi.
Hi. I got more of a comment than I would never really want to go. I think it's more important that we clean up the earth here instead of wasting all that money trying to get to somewhere where it's pretty much desert and nothing, you know, we don't have any resources there. And I think it's important to take care of Mother Earth instead of trying to go elsewhere.
Tree, thanks a lot for the comment. And you know, that raises some good points there. For one thing, is this even a worthy goal? Why should we be thinking about this when there are some clear-cut problems here on good old planet Earth that need money and resources and energy, too?
Yeah, that's a tough question. And, you know, that's sort of a question that you hear a lot just in any type of space exploration question. You know, should we try to go elsewhere and spend money on looking around when we have this other planet that we live on that we already know is habitable and we already know is our home, and, you know, let's invest in Earth. And that's a great point. And I don't know. I wouldn't argue against that. I think, you know, people always invoke sort of the sense of adventure and exploration as a reason for going. But Musk also pointed out, I think, a new and probably more interesting way of thinking about this, which is that we're talking about bringing life elsewhere. You know, we want to become multiplanetary is the word he used. We need to think about getting off Earth for our own purposes, for our own survival. You know, and if we want to continue, as he put it, the light of consciousness, we're going to need another planet to do that in a few billion years at least. So it's more about continuing what we have here as opposed to giving up.
Thanks for that call, Tree. We'll go next to Aaron on the line in Milwaukee. Aaron, hi.
Hi. Thank you for having me on the air. I'm really really excited to be here.
What did you want to bring up?
Well, I was just listening to the last commenter, and you guys brought up sort of one of the things that you guys brought up was that people, a lot of people say that, you know, we should be spending our money here as opposed to doing things like human space travel. And I just wanted to say that I think that's sort of a false dichotomy. You know, we can do both. We can solve problems here, and just throwing more money at the problem isn't necessarily going to fix it. So while we're solving those problems, we can spend some of the other money and resources that we have doing other things. And I think that space travel and expanding humans into space, making us a genuinely interplanetary species, is a really noble long-term goal. You know, there will come a time when there's when there's going to be an extinction-level event on Earth. It's happened before. It's going to happen again. And I think that it's really important that we're able to, you know, even if we survive that event in small numbers, I think it's really important that we're able to maintain the chain of human knowledge.
All right, Aaron, and on board with Elon Musk there. Briefly, Rebecca, what are you watching for next in Plan Mars?
I would like to see another test fire of this engine, the Raptor engine. But, you know, honestly, just talking about how this would be funded and getting into more of the nitty-gritty on the details that don't involve technical, you know, processes and blueprints. Let's talk about what it would look like to grow plants there, and let's talk about who gets to own the farms and, you know, who gets to lead this colony that presumably would need some sort of, you know, justice system and political.
And we leave it there, Rebecca. Thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate your time. That was science writer Rebecca Boyle. She wrote about Elon Musk's plan for Mars colonization for the Atlantic. That's up on the Central Time Facebook page.
If I went to Mars, and I probably won't, one key item for my survival would be coffee. And we're off to a good start today. It is National Coffee Day, also known as International Coffee Day.
Perhaps one day Interplanetary Coffee Day on Mars and planet Earth. Well, some coffee shops around the country are giving away free coffee to mark this occasion.
But not the one that you celebrated National Coffee Day today, but you did not get free coffee.
That's true, and I don't drink coffee every day. So Maybe there was that subtle psychological influence, but no, I had to pony up some money for my coffee.
Yeah, and I celebrated by having exactly the same amount of coffee I do every day. You're able to kind of come and go with coffee.
Right, I like coffee, but I don't know. I'm not as I don't know, addicted. Is that the right word to say you are? As dependent on?
Dependent is the word I would use, and maybe I'm fooling myself. Maybe it's
a symbiotic
addiction.
Relationship.
Yeah, that's it. You know, another good fermented food, as we learned from Sandor Katz today. I'm celebrating fermentation with my coffee dependence.
And you've got lots of folks joining you in celebrating Fermentation Day beverage.
Yeah, consumption.
Consumption.
Well, at this point in the day, it's probably too late to celebrate Caffeinated Coffee Day. Maybe a cup of decaf to mark the occasion, and you could still sleep tonight. No problem.
Sounds good. Well, happy International Coffee Day. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.